I do feel that computer technology, open source, is at the core of politics and political change. Whatever it is that's coming down the pipe, it's going to come through changes in software and the way that we integrate that into human action and the ways that we relate to each other. You know, we are in or on the edge of a new era.
Hello, I am Cody Ellingham, and this is The Transformation of Value, a place for asking questions about freedom, money, and creativity. Today, I'm joined by Eli K.P. William, a Canadian sci-fi novelist, game writer, and translator of Japanese literature. In 2015, he published his first sci-fi novel, Cash Crash Jubilee, the first book in his Jubilee Cycle trilogy. Most recently, he translated The Traveling Tree, Lessons from a Nomadic Life, a book by famed Japanese photographer Hoshino Michio. Eli, welcome to the show.
Yeah, no, thanks for having me.
This genre of science fiction that you write, sometimes it's expressed as speculative fiction. It can explore all sorts of fantastic worlds, alternative realities, new kinds of technology, but really it's asking us, what if? But one thing I find most interesting is thinking about how economics and money work in these imaginary worlds. And in your novel, Cash Crash Jubilee, indeed you explore a different kind of economic order, one where in a future Tokyo, every action from blinking to sexual intercourse is intellectual property owned by corporations that charge licensing fees. People have a body bank computer system implanted in them, which records their actions from moment to moment, charging them a license fee. And of course, if you go bankrupt in this system, you are liquidated. Eli, can you tell me a bit more about this economic system that you imagined in your novel?
As you said, it's based on this idea of the body bank. So people have an integrated computer system in their body. The computer system, records their motions from moment to moment. And the motion data is transmitted to what's the equivalent of the government, which is called the Global Action Transaction Authority, or GATA. And GATA is like a government, or what we know of as a government today, but it's really been pared down to very basic functions. Its only function, really, is to ensure that people pay the correct amount for the actions that they've performed. Also to ensure that if people go bankrupt and they're no longer able to pay for regular actions and fees and so on, that they are no longer allowed to be part of the system. So it really just upholds the economy, and that's its sole role.
This is interesting. One of the characters says in the book, the sole role of the government is to ensure people follow the rules that make the market possible.
Yeah. So there are laws in this world, and they're called credit laws. And so the only basis for law is whether it disrupts the functioning of the free market. And so if you violate certain principles, you have to pay a fee. And so there isn't jail. There's no jail time or any other kind of punishment other than just the payment of money. So you can do anything as long as you can afford to do it, whether it's a legal action or an illegal action.
Well, this is really interesting because in this world, even murder is okay as long as you pay the fee.
Yeah, you have to be able to afford it. Now, murder is going to be very expensive, so most people are not able to afford that, but yes.
And this is fascinating as well. We also have ambient meta costs like acting, transacting, and in some parts of this world, you've imagined even just the state of existing has a fee associated with it.
So technically, the people considered the state of existing to be a fee. I believe that it's not an actual action.
Within the novel, I think it might be a political conversation that's had about whether or not it is an action.
Yeah. So there are political parties. And depending on which direction politics moves, so you can think of it as the equivalent of, say, left wing, right wing, and in today's world, under some regimes, blinking, urination, and so on will be considered an action that you have to pay for. And in other cases, those will be nationalized and no longer considered action. So that's really the kind of core of the political debate.
It's really fascinating, this idea, the political schism between the moderate choice and then the absolute choice
yes.
parties, I think you mentioned. And of course, this world is fascinating because it's a very technology-driven world, right, where you have this these body banks that are attached to people, the way they engage with everything from advertisements to each other is mediated through these devices, right? And the idea that someone would not want to do that is seemed as quite archaic. You've got, there's slang words for people who are nostalgic for the old way of being. Nosties, I think we call them. And this is really interesting, right? Because it's like, well, You will own nothing and you'll be happy is kind of the statement here. You know, everything is digital, everything is licensed on demand. To own physical things like furniture is seen as nostalgic and kind of a bit backwards, right?
That's right, yeah. I think, you know, there are trends towards this and then, of course, reverse trends and counter-reactions. And so at the time I was writing it, it felt like we were really strongly moving in the direction of more digitization, of valuing things that are digital. And so it seemed likely to me that, there would be a counter-reaction, which there was, and that I'm not saying that this is likely, but it seems possible that there could be, a state in the future where people who look back on, analog, what I call in the book analog detritus or anadato, people who look back on, books, paper books, and so on, would be seen as kind of depraved.
Well, it's funny you mention that, because I just saw someone mentioned online that right now is a very good time to be buying 18th and 19th century furniture in the United Kingdom, because there's a real push for like the IKEA modern style.
Yeah.
And so you can pick up Victorian era cabinets for pennies, in a sense, with this change in the fashions, whereas it's lasted 160 years, but the IKEA kind of cardboard bookshelf maybe won't last 5 years. And so there's this kind of interesting physicality to these older things. They kind of last and they pass through time, whereas this fascination with the new and the now, perhaps this is one of the symptoms or diseases of modernity. We're always looking at the now, right?
Yeah, no, I definitely think we have a strong bias towards presentism and focusing on what's going on now. I think part of it is that there is so much happening right now that we have access to that it kind of collapses all of time into the moment. And so, if you look back, for example, to even just 50 years ago, let's say, you can kind of get a handle a little bit on the information that was available at the time. Maybe like, let's say you like horror movies. You could watch all of the horror movies from that decade, probably, that were put out in the English language. Whereas nowadays, there's just so much of every genre and every kind of medium that it's impossible to absorb it all. And so I think we're just stuck constantly grappling with this barrage of endless information in the present, and we almost have no time, no space to try to reach out to other times.
That's interesting. We talk about this epochs of 50 years, and when I was a child, I was really interested in astronomy, and the star charts that you used to be able to buy were in 50-year epochs, star charts. And these kind of periods of 50 years are, in a sense, referenced with this idea of Jubilee, which is in the title of your book, this religious imagery from the Hebrew tradition, the freeing of debt slaves in the 50th year. There's kind of these maybe cycles of maybe 2.5 generations or so where we start to see enough social shift, enough social change that it feels like, okay, that was a point in time in the past and now is quite different. And that maybe 50 years is about the period of time, but this idea of Jubilee in the book, what does this mean?
Yeah, in the context of the book, the main character, his name is Amon Kenzaki, and as we've already talked about, there's this idea of liquidation. So You know, in the modern day, if bankruptcy is actually a way for you to get free of your debts, but in this world, bankruptcy is an unforgivable condition. Once you've passed over a certain line of debt, you're no longer allowed to be part of the action transaction market. So you need to therefore be liquidated. And so Amon Kenzaki is one of the liquidators working for the Liquidation Ministry, which is a part of the Global Action Transaction Authority. He has this dream of a forest that he wants to go to. And so just like any action, going to a forest is going to cost money. Even learning about a forest costs a lot of money. So he's trying to save up. He's becoming really proficient in frugality. He takes lessons on how to blink less, how to not breathe too much. He's very careful about which blocks of sidewalk he steps on, because some blocks of sidewalk at certain moments are owned by companies that charge more. And so he's trying to save up money and succeed as a liquidator, to liquidate efficiently. He has a lot of conviction about the justice of the global transaction market. But then he's charged for this action called Jubilee. And it's outrageously expensive, and it's obscure. He doesn't know what it is, but he knows whatever it is, you know, he hasn't done it, because he's very careful about his actions. And so when he encounters Jubilee initially, he doesn't know what it means, and so he starts to look into it. And then, as you said, it becomes clear eventually that, you know, etymologically speaking, it comes from the Old Testament and this tradition. So in the Jewish tradition, there's the Sabbath years. Every 7 years, you know, there are certain rules that apply, like you have to rest fields and so on. And so every seven years, every 49 years or 50, depending on your interpretation, there's this Jubilee year, which is where you free all slaves and you cancel all debts. So this idea of Jubilee, it takes on a kind of symbolic meaning in the Jubilee Cycle trilogy, because Amon has to pursue this mystery of the Jubilee action, and it leads him along his journeys.
Yeah, and as you say, we have here chapter 25 of the book of Leviticus, and you shall hallow the 50th year and proclaim liberty upon all inhabitants of the land. It shall be a Jubilee for you, and ye shall all return to thy ancestral property, and ye shall all return to thy family. And this idea that there is a forgiveness, a return, an opportunity for, I imagine at least once in someone's life, to have that chance to wipe the slate clean, to start again, is quite a powerful imagery. And what does that mean in society, right? Because in a lot of cases, now we have this situation in the world where you've got things like student loan debt, basically people hocked up with debt that is being really pursued quite rigorously, and you know, what are you going to do? That's sort of, you start building an underclass potentially. So I mean, this is quite relevant to the world we're in today, right?
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. There is the problem of debt to individuals. I mean, student debt is a especially significant problem in, you know, say a country like the United States, where the fees to participate in higher education are extremely large. You know, maybe it's breaking down a little bit, but the perception that you need to have the diploma in order to participate in the economy in an effective way or to maintain your socioeconomic status, that sort of idea was quite prevalent. So there is the individual element. There's also the global perspective, and this isn't really something that I tackle in the novel, because it's really more about individual freedom. But, you know, there are also nations around the world that are heavily indebted, and, you know, grappling with their debts causes a lot of problems. And, you know, there are cycles of debts, countries that get caught in these cycles of debts. There doesn't seem to be, you know, always a clear way for them to get out of it.
What's interesting, this 50-year cycle as well, one of the key moments, I think, in the 20th century, which is, I think there's nuance to it, but as maybe a more simple understanding, it's quite useful, is looking at 1973 and the closing of the gold window under Richard Nixon in the United States, and this kind of symbolic act. I think, as I said, there's more nuance to it, but that happened, and it seems as if after then everything has just become more shit. And I mean, again, what does that actually mean? But there was this period in time where, you know, something like gold, hard money, these kind of older ideas of value existed, and then now we're in this hyper-financialized society. And by all means, it seems as if a lot of the measures of quality of life in somewhere like the US and that have gone down. It's interesting that it seems to line up in the timeline of events, right?
Yeah, I do think it's interesting, you know, referring to the, you know, removal of gold as the basis for, you know, the dollar. People have been buying a lot of gold recently. And I think it's suggestive of, you know, the limits of the current global system that we're under. Like, it seems very clear that, you know, post-World War II, there was this new global liberal order that was put in place. And it's cracking. And, you know, a big component, of course, of that system is finance. And the financial system seems to be cracking. I think that the fact that, you know, gold is of course, the price goes up and down, but it has reached record highs recently, and I think this is telling us that we're reaching a moment where people are very uncertain about finance in general and the direction the world is going, and that, you know, we are in or on the edge of a new era.
What I find interesting is, obviously, the Jewish tradition has this huge emphasis on law. The law of Moses, Ten Commandments, these kinds of things. And it's interesting that even within that system, though, there is still the opportunity for this forgiveness of debts, the freeing of the slaves. And that almost seems like it's kind of in contrast to this pursuing of debtors, this kind of kicking people while they're down, that this kind of absolutism of if you owe the money to the state, in the example of student loans, you must pay or else. And in a sense, it actually reflects maybe your book a little bit. You know, your body bank, really, it seems as if it's a stand-in for social security numbers or credit scores or something. Mm-hmm. And this is really interesting because what does that mean when you don't have a mechanism for forgiveness or for moving on from that? Necessarily, you have revolution, you have people sort of resentment fermenting, etc. Right. So there's kind of, in that sense, it's actually more pernicious than even what we would think of as the covenant of law. You know, there's no way to escape these debts, and so you're chased to the ends of the earth. And in the case of the United States, with its global tax regime, you know, there's not really anywhere you can go and get away from it, right?
Yeah. So, you know, I think one of the worrisome trends or possibilities in the world is that even with a mechanism like bankruptcy, so as I said, in my world, bankruptcy is something that isn't forgiven, whereas bankruptcy is a process of, you know, having your debts forgiven. And even with that sort of system, I think people are still trapped, and in some cases as good as if you were in debt, because there aren't a lot of ways in a lot of societies now to try to rise. And, you know, we have this myth of meritocracy, and we'd like to believe that people have, you know, freedom or equality of opportunity. Hmm. But in actual fact, you know, a lot of people have more resources than others, and that can be the determining factor in the sorts of education that they have from a young age. And so I think that, you know, and education, of course, is determinant of a lot of future success. And in many cases, this is a problem, I think, in China, it's a problem in America, a problem in many places. Yeah. And so the notion of, if there is a notion of forgiveness built into law or into the systems that we build, I think it would need to extend further than debt. I mean, bankruptcy isn't really enough. It would have to go further.
Yeah. Well, that's fascinating. And I think, just zooming out a little bit, of course, you know, your book, sci-fi, there is this history of science fiction, speculative fiction, that is building these worlds. And as we said at the beginning, the idea of the economic systems that inhabit these. And I actually encountered in preparation for this some literature that was actually exploring these concepts, in particular a book, Economic Science Fictions, edited by William Davies. And this came out in around about 2019. And it really got me thinking, you know, in terms of games, literature, film that explores speculative fiction, what sort of worlds have we got? And I mean, to just list off a few, we've got something like the Dune series by Frank Herbert, which has this spice commodity, mm-hmm. this kind yeah. of hard money. We've got something like, I don't know if you remember, In Time, which had Justin Timberlake in it. It was a film.
Oh, I haven't seen that.
So that's where time is this currency, and you trade time, and when you run out, you die with these like embedded clocks in your arm.
I think I skimmed that, if you can skim a movie.
Yeah, I think it might have been based off a book as well, originally. In fact, I don't want to say it was a Philip K. Dick idea, but it probably was. It sounds like something he would.
He sprinkles multiple ideas in each story, so it could be.
We've got one of my favorite video games, Half-Life 2, which mm-hmm. has slave labor. You've got post-scarcity societies like the Halo games. So there's all of these modes of kind of exploring science fiction. But coming back actually to the introduction of this this exploration of economic science fictions, we had the foreword actually by Mark Fisher, who I'm not sure if you're familiar with, Capitalist Realism. So he writes, "Capitalist realism posits capitalism as a system that is free from the sentimental delusions and the comforting mythologies that governed past societies." And in a sense, he sees fiction, science fiction, as a way of kind of exploring, and I guess in the tradition of the left, alternative realities and alternative ways of doing things, and the kind of that role of speculative fiction and kind of informing what is possible, and mm-hmm. and that was sort of the lens that book explores. But I mean, what are your thoughts on sort of how science fiction can explore new economic realities and maybe both a utopian, dystopian, or somewhere in the middle?
Mm-hmm. So there are a lot of economic ideas within science fiction here and there. I think it's among the sciences, you know, of course, you know, so-called hard sciences like physics and chemistry, and then, you know, so-called softer sciences like social sciences, anthropology, sociology. I think among those, economics has been explored less yes. within science fiction. It's been neglected. And when I was writing my trilogy, or you know what would become my trilogy originally, I actually was really struggling to find other examples of it at the time. I think there've been maybe a few more since then, but it's underexplored, and it's kind of curious that it would be underexplored, because as you say, you know, one of the powers of speculative fiction, I'm maybe going to focus on science fiction because I'm more familiar with it than fantasy, is its ability to imagine these other possibilities, and through doing so, I think, shape the perceptions of readers or viewers or whoever about the present and about their world and where they're living now. And economics and finance are so central to the present. Like if you listen to a news broadcast, read an article, listen to some, you know, podcast, how many times does the word GDP come up, or, you know, fiscal or monetary? Or, I mean, in a political discussion, it's so essential, and so much of what we do seems to be geared towards trying to, you know, raise the rate of GDP growth. You know, growth, that's another word we hear all the time. And even though it seems like, you know, our primary goal is to pursue GDP, and nevertheless, we don't have, you know, many speculative fiction stories that are really exploring economics. And I think there's a broad, I mean, we have, you've mentioned some, and of course there are some, but there's not enough. And I think it's partly a failure sometimes to see beyond capitalism. It's very difficult to see beyond it. And of course, people will come up with utopian societies, but you can never quite believe them. You never really, they always, you know, and of course, you know, utopia means no place, right? And this is Thomas More's, when he wrote the original Utopia, is sort of his joke that this could not really be a place, right? And its very name suggests that it couldn't exist. And so it's built into the idea of a utopia that it can't exist, but we still, even if it's not a utopia, a nuanced vision of some kind of future that's beyond capitalism that we can believe in, I think is largely lacking. And of course, that's not what I try to provide in my trilogy at all. It's an exploration of a certain type of capitalism brought to extremes that's exaggerated.
Final point, yeah.
But there are lots of possibilities for exploration of economics-based worlds that we're just not taking advantage of. So I think we need more of that.
What's interesting, you mentioned Thomas More's Utopia, which is referenced in, again in this economic science fictions, where the island that is you know, this island of Utopia is an enclave. It has necessarily to be an island. And one of the critiques in the book, and again, this is looking at it from, I think, you could say a left-leaning perspective, an academic perspective, is that the advent of neoliberalism has removed all enclaves of non-capitalist modes of production. And so certainly the collapse of non-market economies like the Soviet Union, for the most part globally, means that there's nowhere to sort of hide away anymore. And the example that comes to mind for me is something like monasteries or the cloistered monk away from the world. You know, that is just really not a major component of the world, and it's really hard to get away because those people still need to be part of some market system, even if they think that they're away, they're not of the world. They still need to have bank accounts and go into charity and these kinds of things. And so this kind of global moment that we're in today, which again Mark Fisher writes about this idea of capitalist realism in his other book, is that it's easier to imagine the end of the world than the end of capitalism. And for me, as a person very interested in this, I find that kind of a little bit simplistic. This idea that, you know, is there something wrong with money as a concept? It's quite a Marxist idea, and I think there's nuance that we can explore there. But I think the idea, the kind of the intuition that maybe there's can we imagine other ways of being, is actually really challenging right now. And one more thing I would add to that is that this kind of idea of neoliberalism in particular as this sort of final form of capitalism in itself is a kind of science fiction, because it imagines sort of two realities at the same time. One is of the self-authored, you know, individual who's just part of, that they're in control of their own life and they are an economic unit. But at the same time, it imagines a state and a world order that is cohesive enough to enable each individual to be an individual. And those are kind of, when you break them down, that's actually a little bit of a challenge, because ultimately the state is still the platform through which we engage in the market. You know, you need regulations and laws and things to actually facilitate the market. So there's this kind of strange relationship, which I'm not sure if I can fully express, but I think you understand it. And it's perhaps highlighted most clearly by Margaret Thatcher, who said that economics are the method, the object is to change the soul. Mm. And so there's this kind of great project that happened over our lifetime, over the last 50 years, in neoliberalism, that has reimagined the world in a way that it's almost impossible for us here today in 2025 to think about what non-market economies look like.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, so neoliberalism has definitely been a powerful force that shaped the globe. And as you said, the way that we live and our perceptions of the world and what we're capable of imagining and all of those things. I do think the era of, you know, Reagan and Thatcher and so on in the 80s definitely is where neoliberalism hit its stride. But I think, you know, a lot of these transformations, they go back further, and it's you know, happened, unfolded sort of over the centuries. I mean, one of the books that I was sort of thinking about when writing the Jubilee Cycle trilogy is John Locke's Second Treatise on Government. And it's really funny if you read that book, because the ideas that he's expressing, some of them are really at the foundation of all market-based liberal societies, and so he's talking in there about property. And one of the interesting things that he does, you know, he's sort of playing with notions from Hobbes' Leviathan earlier on, and they both have this idea of the state of nature, which is you know, kind of abstract philosophical idea where you start out as these individuals, these sort of atomic individuals. You can imagine it, and I think that Hobbes very much was imagining it this way, as like, you know, atoms moving in a vacuum. So you imagine a social vacuum. It's just these people just moving around with no society. And what would they do? And Hobbes, you know, is very pessimistic and thinks they're just going to fight each other all the time. They're not going to get along. Whereas Locke, he thinks that the market is going to arise. And so for Locke, in a strange way, the market and property rights precede society and the state. And so you have at the basis of all of his thinking, you know, these notions of property rights. And so I think that a lot of what you're talking about, this idea of there being no spaces for us to escape from capitalism, you're talking about monasteries. Part of that, I think, comes from this idea that property rights almost precede society, that there can be no exception to them, and so that everything can be owned. And this is part of the idea that I'm exploring in the Jubilee Cycle trilogy. You know, initially when I came up with the idea, I was imagining like physical objects being owned, like molecules. And so, you know, one company would own this molecule and that, and one company would own that molecule. So when you breathe, you know, you pay a little bit for each molecule. But it seemed like unrealistic to charge people for that. So I thought, well, if ownership is going to pervade all of society, all elements of human life and existence and individual action and perception and so on, if that was going to happen, it seemed more likely that you could charge people for actions. And so that obviously is not exactly how the world works today, but it is a direction that we see things shifting in some areas, you know, being charged fees for all kinds of things that you do online. And as you said earlier, you're talking about the, in Japan, you know, it's like the My Number card, right? And so you have this single number or single kind of digital identity that you go around with everywhere, and that can be a mechanism for charging you.
Well, it's interesting. Are you familiar with the concept of a CBDC, central bank digital currency? Have you come across that?
Yeah, I don't know a lot about it, but I have come across it, yeah.
I think, I mean, this is certainly in my explorations, this is more and more of a topic that's coming up, which is effectively getting rid of physical cash or minimizing the role of physical cash, which is increasing. Certainly New Zealand has basically done away with cash. Japan has still got some cash systems, but moving towards a digital currency that is standardized, run via the state, there's kind of digital infrastructures, there's systems of control, which in a sense with the cash economy, you don't have that. Once it's in cash form, it kind of exists on its own. This is a move that is happening, and at quite high levels, there is this push towards digital money. And this is really interesting because coming back to this idea of ownership, and I think the belief system, or the, I guess, the paradigm of what it means to own something. I was reading an article last night talking about, again, bringing this back to the Western tradition of the Judeo-Christian basis for ownership and of a God-given right to do something and the responsibilities that come with that. There's sort of a covenant there that you have dominion over these lands and these animals and this, you know, you must. However, by having dominion over that, there's responsibilities for that, and there's a law that comes with that, which sort of sits in contrast to maybe the social contract theory, which does away with a religious basis for ownership and law, and replaces it with a social contract and more of a, yeah, there's sort of an enlightened idea, maybe Locke and these come out of that.
Locke did have a religious basis for it, but I think Hobbes didn't,
yeah.
And I think that's true of the social contract theory in general.
Yeah, so there's this kind of interesting parallel where, you know, for example, what does it mean to own the means of production, perhaps from a Christian perspective, is that to extend God's kingdom over the earth? Or what does that mean in a kind of a secular social contract theory? You know, if you own the means of production, you are that, you know, you just happen to own it, and then there's no kind of strings attached with that, and it can become maybe a little bit out of control in the sense we see with this kind of Silicon Valley big tech kind of phenomena that's taking place, right?
Yeah, I mean, I don't always, you know, approach moral questions from a religious angle necessarily. I think, you know, religious traditions can definitely be, you know, a source of moral principles for many people. And I think what you're getting at is the way in which we've sort of, in a lot of different areas, leaving moral principles and morality and moral constraints by the wayside, that everything becomes about efficiency and some notion of what efficiency means, because it can mean different things. And so, you know, with ownership, right, like you could have ownership, as you said, it could be a kind of stewardship, right? If you have this piece of land, there are these kind of moral principles, you know, you have to take care of the land, you have to nurture it, that, you know, would automatically attach to your ownership of the land. But I think ownership itself is bereft or divided from those types of moral principles. And yeah, I think we see the hollowing out of those moral principles also with, I think, the democratic crisis we're seeing in certain places. I mean, most notably, of course, the United States at the moment, that even the principles of, you know, fair election and democracy and, you know, the balancing of powers and all of those things that would make the property system function in a fair way, even those are up for question, and even the moral principles that would or beliefs that would guide us to protect those are up in the air.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting bringing it back to body banks, my number, social security numbers, all of the, this kind of technocratic, these technocratic artifacts and systems that have been developed, they very much sit in this kind of very strange place where if you do really do zoom out, it's such a strange thing to give somebody a number, you know, to make their life, their entire existence is sort of hanging off of this string of integers. And making that the core of the way society functions is a very strange thing. And extending that all the way to money and making it eternal and forever, again, it also precludes the possibility that you can be outside of that system. And, you know, you think, well, if someone doesn't have a social security number, there's almost nothing they can do in terms of getting bank accounts, being part of what we think of as the system. Yet for up until, in fact, living memory, people in the Great Depression, for example, you know, there was a period of time when, you know, people, those systems didn't exist, and you could exist as this, yeah, this kind of in this raw nature, right? Like the Hobbesian kind of vision where you are just out there doing your thing. And I mean, I don't know what to make of this, but it's really strange that, like, we've just sort of walked into the system now. And in somewhere like Japan, where I've had conversations with people about, you know, there are people, for example, like Kurdish refugees who came over here in the 90s. In a lot of cases, they don't actually have the standard documentation required. They're not illegally here, but they are, you know, refugees, they are asylum seekers and whatnot. And so they find it very difficult to access things like healthcare and to be part of society, even though they're here and there's nowhere for them to go back to. And so there's this kind of, what happens when you have people who sort of slip through the cracks? You know what I mean?
Yeah. I mean, there's a lot I could say about that. I mean, so in terms of people who slip through the cracks, I mean, this is something we've been talking about my trilogy in general in the first book, but the second book, The Naked World, is really about people outside the system. One thing, in my world, it's very clear cut. So there's nobody in between. You're either in the system or you're completely excluded from it. And so those people are called bank dead. And they, I won't get too much into the details of it because it would take us too far astray. But they live in a sort of state of constant reliance and dependence on the action transaction market, even though they're not a part of it. as part of something called the charity gift economy. But in any case, turning back to what you were saying about digital identities and my number card and exclusion, I'm not quite as skeptical of the idea of having somebody have an official identity as others might be. So one thing that I sort of discovered through writing the first novel was this idea of, I call it the House of Blinding, and it's a government institution that it's an independent institution that's outside the rest of the government, and it's in charge of encryption of identity. And, people can obviously challenge the plausibility of this and how would it technically work and all of that. But it allows people to have an official identity, but to determine how much of it to expose. And so they can, for example, if you click on somebody in my world, in the world of the Jubilee Cycle trilogy, they can say, okay, I'm going to set my privacy settings so that you can only have my name or you can have nothing. You can't even see my face because I have, Digimake covering me up and I look like someone else. Or, you could click on them and you give them your whole life stream and they can watch a video of your entire life. And so it's entirely up to you. And I feel that, on the one hand, I agree that we do need outside spaces. And I think one way I think of it is in terms of public spaces. Like, we have a tendency to try to commodify everything so much that we don't leave public spaces for people to just to go and not have to pay anything. There's no, bar for entry. You can just go and be a part of the space. I think we need more spaces like that. And we do need anonymous spaces and pseudonymous spaces, places where we can not expose all of who we are. But I also think that if the official identity is not necessarily bad, it's a question of how it's managed. It might be better to have it managed in some way by a democratically organized unit within civil society as opposed to the state, or there could be some well-balanced institution within a state that could manage it in a way that allows us to utilize the benefits of an official identity without allowing us to have too many of the disadvantages.
Yeah, well, even on that note, I mean, you're talking about the state here, but the bank death, identity death of losing your Facebook account or your YouTube channel. I mean, that is this new wild west we're in where, some 15, 20 years of someone's life can be tied up with this, this private company. And that's kind of a new thing, right? And it's like, I don't really care about my passport, but if I lose access to my social media, that's the true tragedy. And I mean, that's the new reality we're in. And I think we're already starting to see that maybe this kind of state-private sector kind of crossover there with something like Facebook and Google, who are, even though private companies, they are pseudo-states in a sense, maybe in bigger GDPs than many countries. There's this kind of interesting situation there where official identity is one thing, but then social media identity is another thing, right?
Yeah, no, I think it's a total mess in that regard. I totally agree. And I think we have a bad understanding of what constitutes, the elements of sovereignty these days. And what I mean is, like, if you look at, the American Constitution, clauses in there about, like, the post, right? Like, how do you organize the post, right? Which is, like, a, important technology in the 18th century, right? There's obviously nothing in there about, like, how do we deal with, social identities. And so there's all these new technologies that have arisen that seem like they're crucial to sovereignty in some sense, that they're part of what's integral to, the ruling power or state power or to democratic power if the people are in charge. But they're all fragmented in bits and pieces. So, Amazon has the everything store, a bunch of a social oligopoly has is in charge of the social identity. And I really think we need to clean house, as a people and try to bring those elements together, make things more interchangeable so that they're flexible, not to the needs of, in the case of social identities, advertisers, but individual needs so that they're configured, the algorithms are configured in ways that promote rational action and rational behavior rather than greatly hinder them. And so I think there are all kinds of ways in which we can bring those things together into elements of sovereignty that would benefit all of us.
Well, it's interesting. You'd be familiar with concepts like open source software, right?
Yeah, yeah, and absolutely.
I wonder whether this new digital layer, this internet layer that is so important to our lives now, whether something like open source protocols and systems that are not tied with individual companies are going to be more important. And obviously something like Linux is already powering most of the internet, but at a protocol level, looking at identity, I think there's more and more, especially with changes with X and the way social media has been unfolding over the last sort of decade, there is more and more of an interest in, okay, what would an open source protocol look like for social media?
Yeah, so I think with social media, in that case, I mean, we have the Fediverse, right? And which is, you know, obviously a total mess in a lot of ways. And then, you know, of course, with any new technology, you have companies who are going to jump in and try to commodify it. So you have Threads is trying to get a piece of the Fediverse, and then also Blue Sky is, you know, integrated with it. And I do see a lot of promise in open source. The problem with it is within the, you know, neoliberal capitalist system is how do you create the right incentives to keep those systems functioning? I think a great model for something, and I don't know if it would apply wholesale to other areas, is like Wikipedia is amazing, yeah. Right? You have, it's like, got this sort of self-organizing component to it, but you also have, you know, the Wikimedia Foundation at the top, kind of overseeing everything, and a lot of it's funded through donation. And, you know, I mean, when you look at a Wikipedia article, it's the article at that moment, and, you know, there could be some flaws with it, and, you know, we've all seen things that don't make sense on there. But over time and on the whole, you have different perspectives in there, and it's immensely informative, and it's a great place to start research, of course. You know, you go there and then it can guide you to other areas. And how do we extend something like that? I mean, Wikipedia is like an institution, and there's no guarantee that it's going to hold out forever. And so how do we create institutions like that in other domains of, you know, our social endeavors, right? Like social media.
Yeah, well, we're still, I think, I zoom out again to look at this idea, though, of imagining new ways of doing things. And if we do come back to these fictional stories and games and films that try to explore this space and this landscape, again, I mean, we're not often presented with compelling cases, and as we mentioned earlier, I mean, a lot of them just reference the way things were before, whether it's slave labor, utopian post-scarcity visions, you know, kind of wacky ideas like, I don't know if you're familiar with Cory Doctorow's Wuffy economy. It's sort of like a reputation economy in the future, and his book Down and Out in the Magic Kingdom. There's different kind of imaginations of it, but we're still stuck with sort of quite simplistic ideas of, you know, well, if it was only like this. And I mean, is it even possible to imagine a new system while we're in the current system? Or is this necessarily an emergent thing that we have to just go through this?
I think if you look at the history of capitalism, it suggests that it may be something emergent. So, you know, if the Industrial Revolution, the enclosure movement within England, a lot of the social transformations that made capitalism possible were already ongoing when Adam Smith came out, you know, and created a theory to help explain that. And so,
kind of post hoc, right?
Yeah, like you have the phenomena arise, and then people will often, you know, explain them after the fact. And so, in advance, building a whole political system or a new era in the abstract, I think, would be extremely difficult. And so it may be something that emerges, but I do think that the ideas that we come up with along the way will guide that emergence, and that our ideas are, whether they're like our speculations within science fiction or our theories, or, you know, our podcasts and conversations like that, they guide the emergence process. But it could be that in this era in history that it does come about the other way, that there is a theory and that, you know, the world unfolds in accordance with that. I mean, I think you see that more with Marxism, that Marxism, you know, whether you love it or hate it, was a theory that actually brought about change in the world.
Well, and this was one of Marx's important points, I think, was the importance of action and the praxis of changing things and not just sort of being academic about it. And I think this was maybe what we're getting at here, that we have already in many ways the future at our fingertips, and we're not, it's just not evenly distributed, as William Gibson would say. And it, you know, we look at something like Bitcoin, which, you know, I'm very passionate about, and I think, man, what is this? I'm doing it. It's real. It's not just an idea. And maybe when it came out, it was informed by ideas. But even then, I mean, it was built off previous work, but it was quite action oriented. You know, let's build. And this is something the cypherpunks, who were the ones who sort of in the 90s were trying to develop a lot of these encryption technologies and this ongoing sort of struggle with the state and state overreach. One of the maxims is cypherpunks write code. And so there's this kind of action imperative as opposed to sort of the armchair analysis. And that then turns into reality. Mm-hmm. And here we are today, where I use Bitcoin every day. There's all sorts of political changes. I was just talking to some people who in a way helped inform Trump's policy towards Bitcoin, who, you know, this announced these strategic Bitcoin reserves and things. You know, there's this like real political affect where Bitcoin now is like a geopolitical force. Mm-hmm. Whereas it just started out as a small open source project.
Absolutely.
You know? So there's this kind of interesting mixture between action and theory, right?
Yeah, no, I find the history of, you know, Bitcoin and cryptocurrency very interesting. I'm not an expert in it in the way that you are, but it is really, you know, whether cryptocurrency on the whole has been beneficial to the world. I mean, there are a lot of problems it's created. I think a lot of it makes money laundering quite easy. There are a lot of these scam rings, like the pork butchering rings, that largely enabled by cryptocurrencies, ransomware scams. This is not specific to Bitcoin, I know, which is your area, but cryptocurrency in general. You know, I think that a lot of the revolutionary potential within cryptocurrency in general was this idea of decentralization. And I found watching cryptocurrency unfold as a social and technical process interesting, because it is one of the rare areas where you do see like little hints of something different, right? It does feel different from, you know, the system that we live under. I don't personally see it as like cohesive, and you know, their cryptocurrency is so broad, but there, you know, a lot of misadventures in there, to put it lightly. But my concern for a long time that's been played out, and you've just partly referred to it with, you know, the strategic Bitcoin assets, is that the revolutionary potential, if there was any, within cryptocurrency would be forfeited as it's centralized and becomes part of the state system. And that seems to be what's going on in America. You know, there was the lobbying effort to try to get Trump, who was originally opposed to cryptocurrencies, on board with the Crypto Bro project. And then he got on board, and now, you know, it's become this system for corruption, for essentially bribes to the American government. Again, it's not specific to Bitcoin, but to cryptocurrency in general. And so it's being centralized and sort of absorbed into the state in a certain way. And this is something that I have worried about for many years. And, it, you know, I just wonder if there is at that point any revolutionary potential left in it, or if it just becomes another element of the standard financial system.
Yeah, no, that's a very valid point. And I guess I consider my stance on this, I'm certainly in the camp that sort of sees the revolutionary potential as paramount. And along the way, there's necessarily the involvement of the state in certain ways. But what does that look like in real time? As I said, having phone calls with people who are involved with something like pushing for the strategic Bitcoin reserve and advising governments, for myself even, I am part of an organization in New Zealand that has been working to inform politicians. I mean, just a few weeks ago, I was back in New Zealand presenting on Bitcoin to MPs and ministers in New Zealand, trying to get them to understand why we need to review the tax treatment of Bitcoin, etc. So certainly I'm part of that side of it. But fundamentally, I guess my pathway I see is that through that normalization and I guess acceptance by the state, we kind of Trojan horse it, and then they, because they're not in control of the protocol, there's
it's not playing a dangerous game.
I know, it's an ongoing conversation, and I'm really trying to be nuanced and careful and critical of what I'm doing and what is happening with the project. But it is, I mean, it's got an energy of its own. It's kind of, yeah.
I want to say in that regard, with the Trojan Horse Project, I would say at this moment in time, it's like, it's looking bad, right? Like if cryptocurrency had sort of been institutionalized through a government that many of us saw had legitimacy, or an administration at least that had a legitimacy, then I think it would be better for optics and sort of better for reception of it as something that's not just like, you know, like I said, used for corruption or for criminal enterprises. And so it really, because it's emerging through the Trump administration, it really kind of looks bad right now for that project of trying to turn the infiltration around into something that's more revolutionary.
Yeah, I think I understand. I mean, there's a few people in particular, commentators who, one person in particular, Mike Brock, who I interviewed, and you know, he used to work in Bitcoin at quite a senior level. And now he's basically turned his back on it because he sees that relationship as untenable because of the involvement of the Trump administration. And I think that's, look, I mean, that's his right to have that opinion. But I do wonder whether we zoom out a little bit and take on the lens just for a moment of someone like Curtis Yarvin. Are you familiar with his writing?
Yeah, a little bit, yeah.
So this kind of, techno-feudalism, this kind of dark imagining of, say, the end of democracy and the, and again, I don't necessarily believe this, but his lens at least is that what is happening is that cryptocurrency is getting kind of set up to swap out a failing economy and it kind of ushering in like a Wild West where, yeah, everyone's getting scammed by everyone. There's just rampant corruption. It's not even hidden beneath the veil anymore. But it's kind of setting that up to take the stage so that at least if you're lucky and you make a gamble, you can get rich in the crypto market, for example. And the kind of this Wild West kind of an idea and also reflecting maybe a sort of a late empire vibes, sort of, you know, what we're under Nero, you know, what happens as Rome burns. And kind of there's imagery there which is very confronting. Because you can also maybe optimistically take a step back and think this is, you know, it's going to be okay. We've got an election in a couple of years. You know, we'll swap them out. You know.
Will we?
and that's the thing, you know, does it only become fascism once there is no election? You know, I don't know. But we're in that period right now where I think it's important to look at that without being a Cassandra and also without being just, you know, head in the sand. What does that all mean as a sort of a world order changes? What necessarily happens with money, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, no, I mean, I can see how from, you know, a Bitcoiner perspective, you want to take the long view and think, you know, this is just one step along the road and could be true. I think it's interesting when you mentioned Curtis Yarvin. You know, I don't know a lot about his work, just a little bit, but I believe that, you know, he's a coder himself, and I believe he put together this kind of operating system. I've forgotten the name of it. But from what I think it's very opaque, like what exactly it does, like nobody really knows. From what I can gather, it was some sort of instantiation through some sort of OS and social network of techno-feudalism, to build it like right into the core of the software in some way. The reason I mention that is just that I do feel that computer technology, open source, is at the core of politics and political change. Whatever it is that's coming down the pipe, it's going to come through changes in software and the way that we integrate that into human action and the ways that we relate to each other. So cryptocurrency is a case of that. As you said, right off the top, let's build things, right? So it became a mode of political action, and and then maybe there's other people who are saying, no, let's like build these techno-feudalist systems. And I don't know of any of those that have gotten off the ground, but you can imagine that. And so I think a lot of our like political action and our moves to create new politics moving forward has to be through creating these forms of digital interaction, and that may involve, hopefully, optimistically, spaces for us to step away from that and not to be a part of it. But I think that's the direction we're heading.
So on that note, so this is also something I've explored. there's a couple of projects like the Network State, mm-hmm. which, and I've spoken to people about this. I recently interviewed Patrick Friedman, who's really interested in seasteading, and he's associated with people like Peter Thiel. These charter cities, these new modes of organization. And part of the reason I wanted to talk to Patry in particular was I've seen criticisms coming out, in particular from the left, that this represents a kind of exit from the social contract. To have, say, to do seasteading or to have a charter city somewhere on some island where, you've kind of hidden yourself away, you've disconnected yourself from the flow of global culture and society. And the words they used, these commentators used to describe someone like Patrick Friedman was end times fascists, because they're not responsible for what's going on, and they go to their bunker. And even New Zealand is a place where we've got, the city of Queenstown, where these billionaires have got bunkers in the mountains. And in between all these people, what does this all mean? And what you mentioned about computers is really interesting as well, because you've also got, the often quoted AI moment, the singularity, where maybe you've suddenly got a system that can just see everything and know everything. I don't know if I believe that. I think there is a bubble component to that.
You do.
But the idea that computer technology will become so integrated and essential to our political lives that, of course, money needs to be in that sort of fold as well. It's quite interesting, and it represents perhaps a pathway, that there's an inevitability to those ideas, right? That we're going to just keep going and keep ratcheting up the technology, and so it would be impossible to ever go backwards. And I don't know how I feel about that, but it seems like that's sort of a narrative that's been given to us.
Mm-hmm.
It's not necessarily the case. I come from a slightly rural kind of a place. Like, there is a reality of what it means to be out in the world and mm-hmm. physically, it's cold and it's wet and you have to build shelter and do things. The computer cannot do those things, right?
Yeah.
So I don't know what your thoughts are on that, but there is an inevitability, I sense, to that kind of computer logic.
Yeah, so I mean, first of all, just to start off, I don't think that, communities of all billionaires, or maybe, if you have hundreds of millions of dollars that you can get into, I don't think that those are, going to build us some inspiring new societies that we're all going to want to emulate. I don't see that coming. But in terms of the question about software and the role of computation and this sort of update culture that we have, where we're always trying to update, it's always just a line, moving up a graph in one direction, and there's, no averting it. What I see in a more optimistic vein, is the possibility to come up with digital forms of cooperation that could allow us to make more rational, moral, engaged decisions about what we do with the growth of technology. So I don't see it as inevitable that, we become increasingly, more cybernetic and more like cyborgs until, you know, we're just like lumps of metal sending out electric signals. That is not where we have to go. I just think that so much of the political energy, so much of our attention is bound up with digital networks, that our political future has to harness that in some way, and in ways that we're not currently doing, and in innovative ways.
Here's an interesting thought experiment. So again, I mean, the simplistic argument of galactic credits, or, you know, some kind of monad credit system is quite common in sci-fi. But if we come back to something like the spice of Dune, or other commodity monies, commodity economic systems, the one that really comes to mind is energy. Energy as money. And on an optimistic note, I actually think that there's a real opportunity with Bitcoin in particular to bootstrap the Kardashev civilization that requires more energy to power the economy. And by virtue, it's like, well, what are we going to do? We're not going to mine any more coal. We have to build solar and nuclear. And that increases the economy. And there's this sort of flywheel effect. And I have seen this with my own eyes, which is quite profound. But seeing renewable energy being supplemented and enhanced and augmented with something like Bitcoin mining.
Huh.
So, for example, in the South Island of New Zealand, I am doing some Bitcoin mining with a company there. And when there's no demand or less demand from the grid, our machines flick on and start mining Bitcoin. And then when the spot price goes up and the grid needs the energy, we turn off because it's no longer profitable for us, because we need the lowest cost energy. And there's this kind of almost like a bioorganism where the algae, or the bottom feeder, you could say, you know, who simply needs the lowest cost energy, that is Bitcoin mining, can come in with something like solar or hydro, where, you know, with solar during the middle of the day, when all of this, you know, no one's using power at home. People are not using energy in the same way as they are in the evenings. There's always this kind of moment in the middle of the day where you can even get negative pricing, because the electricity needs to be consumed, otherwise it fries the cables. And so there's this emerging economics of renewable energy, which Bitcoin and to a lesser degree data centers, but they have their own challenges. But I think data centers are seen as less confronting than Bitcoin, because Bitcoin has got these associations, unfortunately, with negative externalities for some reason. But I think an actual nuanced argument would, you could look at it and say, actually, this is the best way to do it, because you can just flick Bitcoin off, you know, you can turn the machines off and on without any issues. And so there's kind of a long-term trajectory there, where those bootstrap more renewable energies, they maybe help us avert the climate crisis by necessarily making renewable energy more cost-effective, and kind of that system actually is what bootstraps us into the next era. So, I mean, that's kind of speculative, but I have seen it with my own eyes. So.
Yeah, I mean, so there's a couple of things. I mean, one thing I worry about with the energy revolution, like, so right now, China is just mass producing huge numbers of solar panels. Right. I mean, I can't quote you precise figures. I mean, they've just installed enormous numbers of these panels, a decent amount of wind as well. They're pushing a revolution, and because of the price, the low price, and, you know, the need to make a shift away from, you know, carbon intensive economies. I mean, a lot of countries around the world are going to buy those cheap panels, and so that's unfolding. There is with the rise of AI, one thing I worry about, and I do think cryptocurrency is part of this, because and again, correct me if I'm wrong, but like, you know, the verification algorithm, right, when you do proof of work, it's very energy intensive. So I can understand how you would want to use the lowest cost energy and, you know, sort of power those cryptographic operations like in the cheapest way possible. But you could imagine it doesn't have to be Bitcoin operations that are being powered by the energy. It could be something else. So if you build a house, right, maybe you get some kind of like insulation gains. All right, like we've got a new insulator in the walls. Let's build bigger windows, right? And so you know, maybe the windows have great insulation, they're double paned or, I don't know, triple paned. And but the window itself is not as well insulated as the wall. And so when you get these insulation gains, you just build bigger windows. And so my concern is, okay, we've got cheap solar, cheap renewable energy. Potentially, we can reduce the amount of carbon emissions we're creating. But then I think there's another incentive that says, no, let's just use more energy. And AI is definitely heading in that direction. I don't see, from my understanding, the cryptocurrency like as this runaway, you know, energy hog. But I do think as a form of crypto, of currency or asset, as according to my understanding, that it is energy intensive. And so, at some point, we need to put on the brakes a little bit with energy use. That, you know, energy use should be in proportion to production and what we can produce. And I still think we can have rich economies within that range. It doesn't have to be constant energy hogging to, you know.
Well, this is interesting because this kind of, in this book, The Economic Science Fictions, I found a graphic here that kind of outlines a way of building a speculative context for economic paradigms in fiction. And underneath all of it, there's a philosophy, and whether that philosophy is growth, degrowth, stasis, or transformation. And what you're describing, using less energy, I mean, that would sort of be maybe a stasis or degrowth philosophy. But the opposite, which is, I think, true for all of human civilization, is that flourishing and energy use go together. And we don't necessarily need to be married to any particular philosophy, but, you know, running the thought experiments for each one, what does a philosophy of growth mean, maybe tailored or kind of augmented with sort of a sustainability angle, but as opposed to a degrowth philosophy, which is certainly quite popular right now, you know, let's just slow down and tap the brakes. Because I have my own personal opinions. I happen to think degrowth is challenging, and there's negative consequences for that. But at the same time, you know, unmitigated growth can also have its own issues, right? So maybe the role of speculative fiction sci-fi here is almost to explore how, almost compare and contrast, how could these different philosophies, how could different modes of production, how could different modes of social organization mix and match, and sort of what's the diagram of all of those? And then starting to paint a picture without having without having the one we want to win sort of highlighted, but actually just looking at all of them and laying them out. And then looking at what's actually happening, because I think that's where we can be, Adam Smith commenting on what he sees around him. What are we actually seeing happening? Are we really seeing degrowth take off? Or are we seeing, as you say, unimaginable amounts of solar panels being put on every roof, everywhere, with all of this energy in the middle of the day when the sun is up that's not being used for anything? It's negatively priced. What could we do with that? You know, and maybe start to kind of reference the kind of the praxis.
Yeah. So just for the record, I'm not wedded to degrowth.
Yeah.
It's just I think we're in a climate crisis, and so we tend to over prioritize, you know, growth and GDP. And there's like a range where, you know, we don't have to go into economic contraction, where we shift the way that we organize our industries so that we bring energy in proportion, you know, with energy use in proportion with production. And so, you know, if renewable energy's production is growing rapidly, then we don't want to just start immediately putting on all of these energy intensive industries online right away. We can grow in other ways and stay within the range of the renewable energy and shift out of, you know, use of hydrocarbons for power. I don't think that necessarily means economic contraction. There's a way of doing that that allows us to continue to grow, maybe not at the same rate as we might want. But then it also gets into the question of, you know, GDP as the ultimate metric of the direction that society is supposed to go. I mean, we unfortunately don't have a better metric, but
I mean, there's people who've, I think, explored this. I mean, I think it's one of these simplistic numbers that is used for political means. It's sort of that every man can understand, you know, this is the GDP of the country, right? And I think there certainly there is a lot of other measures that are used technically by, I guess, specialists, but we don't have a way of communicating that to a democratic population in a way that's like easy to consume. I mean, certainly other, you know, there's other measures of success and well-being and all sorts of things, right? So, I mean, GDP, it's a number, and number go up. So, yeah, you know. I mean, the other thing I just wanted to comment on as well is part of this kind of sci-fi visionary future is also the role of something like universal basic income, which is kind of the opposite of your book, right? It's like, well, what if everyone just had a baseline of their needs met? Mm-hmm. And I mean, this is experimented with, people play with it. What is the, so, you know, there's kind of a, there's a cost, obviously, but there's mm-hmm. also a, maybe a social benefit. And I think this is an interesting place to explore. What are the economic ramifications? What are the social ramifications? Is it a good idea, or should we banish it to the waste bin of history?
I that's never made a lot of sense to me. So I think we have, like, in not necessarily socialist democratic societies, but societies with elements of socialism baked into them, you know, Canada, I imagine New Zealand, Japan, a lot of different countries in Europe. There are systems of redistribution. And so, like, if your income is at a low enough level, you'll be provided with welfare. There are basic social programs in a lot of countries, like, so if you can't afford Medicare, you're provided with Medicare. And so a lot of these systems maybe are inadequate and they could be improved, but the goal of systems like that is to take care of those who really need it. I don't really see what is added by writing a check to everyone. Like, if you know, take care of people who are really in need, yes, but not just send money out to everyone. It seems like it's just going to increase inflation.
Well, that's interesting to say that, because I think that's a common critique. And the idea of, like, well, what is need is it becomes a social question. Whereas if you give it to everyone, at least it's a fair situation. But I just wanted to comment that I saw some news yesterday. In Japan, there's obviously a high price of rice, which is for cultural reasons. It's a staple cereal. We've got these okome ken, these rice coupons, kind of like food stamps, that are being proposed to be sent out to, I think to everybody. I'm not 100% sure who's getting them, but they're these kind of, you know, the rice, the staple food of Japan. It's the word that people use to mean food. You know, gohan means food, it means also means rice, is being sent out to people. And this is interesting because it's sort of, you know, in a sense, that's your basic need met with something like, you know, a bowl of rice. But what you said about redistribution is also interesting, because there's an argument that it wouldn't be redistribution because the state would be just printing that money into existence. And that sort of, again, it's a narrative. You know, are we using taxpayer money to give this to someone, or is this simply
printing
the money into existence, which is sort of the modern monetary theory's angle on it. I don't necessarily believe this, but this is their angle, that, you know, we're, for social cohesion, for the benefit of all, there should be a baseline. And I mean, it's just interesting to play with.
Yeah, so I mean, I think theoretically, like, if you look at proponents within liberal theory of redistribution, like somebody like John Rawls, you know, he's really thinking about redistributing wealth and wealth distributions across a whole society. But as we know, you know, raising taxes or, you know, creating an inheritance tax and all of those things are really democratically difficult to implement. And so I think a lot of politicians are timid and afraid to redistribute. And there are a lot of political challenges. You know, there, for example, Switzerland was trying to put in place an inheritance tax recently. And the billionaires, of course, are up in arms, right? They're like, we're out of here, you know? And so I think it's redistribution in our, you know, neoliberal flavored, semi-democratic, semi-plutocratic societies that we live in today. It's very difficult to implement. So the impetus is then to just do what you said and just, okay, well, we'll just make money out of thin air. But in theory, at least, it's supposed to be redistributed within, you know, traditional liberal justice theory, let's say.
Interesting. And I mean, we were talking before, there's nowhere to run away to, but in a sense, you know, perhaps the new monasteries are the billionaires' going to their bunkers, you know, and exiting the system. But this is all very interesting, Eli. We're exploring political economy, sci-fi, the speculation on where economies could go. I am keen to just talk a little bit, though, about what's next for you. I mean, you've just finished your translation of, and this is totally different tangent, but your translation of Hoshino Michio. So just tell us a little bit about that. If people want to track that down, what's that about?
Absolutely, yeah. So Hoshino Michio, he's a Japanese photographer and essayist. He originally from Chiba, just on the edge of Tokyo, and he became just utterly fascinated with Alaska. And so he moved to Alaska at a young age, and his initial introduction to Alaska was living with an Inuit family. And so he lived with them and then traveled across Alaska, did all kinds of really adventurous things, you know, climbing mountains, you know, sleeping on glaciers, and took beautiful photographs of nature and the people of Alaska, wrote beautiful essays about them. And then tragically, this is in 1996, he was killed by a bear in Kamchatka.
Bear.
Yeah, he was killed by, and so he was right at the sort of peak of his career as a photographer, as an essayist, and was tragically killed. So when I first moved to Japan, or first came here actually as a student, there was still like a sort of mood of mourning around his life. And so on big public broadcasters like NHK, they would have documentaries about him. And I lived with a family at the time, and the mother recommended his work. She was a big fan, still is. And so I learned about his, what I think is his best book, The Traveling Tree, Tabio Tsuruki, from my homestay mother when I first came to Japan. And I wasn't actually able to read Japanese then, but it was the second book that I ever read in Japanese. I was still learning the language. And it was the first book I think I ever wanted to translate. And it took until last year to finally, you know, get a publisher interested in it. And so I translated that book earlier this year. It's come out with an imprint called Gaia, which is part of Hachette. And it's just been released in the UK last month, and should be due for release in February in America. Yeah. Next year. It's a beautiful book just about Hoshino's life, a collection of essays, you know, covering his early journeys in the 60s to America, roaming around as a teenager, and his time with the Inuit families, and his life as a photographer, traveling across, you know, Alaska and other places.
Yeah, that's fascinating. And as you say, I mean, he had this deep fascination with the wildlife, and so it was a tragic end to his life. But certainly I'm familiar with his work as photography in particular is quite incredible. And then just what's next for you? What are you working on at the moment?
So right now, I have signed a contract with an imprint of MIT Press to do an anthology of pre-World War II Japanese science fiction. So I'm in the story selection phase right now. I should submit the final list of stories by the end of the month. And so we'll be translating this book into English next year. It's a lot of... I don't think pre-World War II sci-fi is known in the English world. It's going to be the first anthology of its kind, so I'm excited about this.
Yeah.
And also doing a lot of research into the history of Japanese sci-fi at the moment. I'm hoping to get ready to write a book proposal on that.
Yeah, that's really incredible. And I think we talked about this a couple of weeks back, but there was a really good exhibition in Setagaya in Tokyo where they had some images and original manuscript pages and illustrations from this period of early Japanese sci-fi, and it's quite, for me, it was kind of quite tragic to see the descent into the wartime Japan that sort of brought a lot of that to an end, and the sort of the utopianism of that sci-fi kind of getting cut short by the Pacific War. But I don't know, it's sort of, you could see there's a sense of a lot of optimism or kind of like a vision for the future that existed in some of that early work. I mean, is that something that you sort of found with the pre-war stuff?
Well, at the moment, I'm looking exclusively at short stories,
okay.
And so it's quite a bit different than that. This is short stories written, actually, and a little bit of poetry written from 1920 until supposed to be 1945, but I'm going to try to squeeze in a story from 1947 because it's just really cool. And what was going on with Japanese sci-fi, and sci-fi is actually an anachronism in this case because they didn't have that word yet. They, you know, there was the science novel, but that often meant like a sort of educational story about teaching people about science through fiction. So you have to kind of search for sci-fi in bits and pieces in other genres. And so there's sci-fi that appears in modernism. And so there's some modernist writers associated with like Shinkan Kakuha, like the sort of new perception movement. And so some of them are writing science fiction. There's science fiction that is part of the detective genre. There's two strands of detective fiction at that time, the traditional or authentic one, and then the sort of more weird one. And so sci-fi gets kind of woven into the weird detective fiction of the 1920s and 1930s. And then later on, Japan, of course, you know, shifts into full-on fascism in the 30s. And so at that point, a lot of it starts to be written in the service of the state efforts. And so there's a sort of propaganda sci-fi also, okay, also that arises then. Yeah, so there's a range of different things happening in sci-fi in that period.
Interesting. And if people want to find you, where would you like to send them?
Oh, well, good place to start is my website, elikpwilliam.com. Also, I have a Substack called Almost Real, elikpwilliam.substack.com. I write there about a lot of the things we've discussed today, futurism, philosophy, Japanese sci-fi, politics, and all of the above.
Great. Thank you very much. That's awesome.
Yeah, thanks. That was a lot of fun. Thank you.